by any means necessary.
And we're going to keep the movement moving on, as they say. We're now happy to be joined by Greg Ehlich, Korea Policy Institute board member and a contributor to the collection Sanctions as War, Anti-Imperialist Perspectives on American Geo-Economic Strategy. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. Nice to be back.
Absolutely. And it's always nice to have you back, Greg. And we've been seeing reports of demonstrations of tens of thousands of people in the DPRK or North Korea marking the anniversary of the Korean War. And I actually wanted to read just a little bit from a piece that was published by the Associated Press on this that I think pretty well encapsulates a lot of how the Korean War is considered in sort of the mass consciousness in the U.S. The AP piece says, quote, "While the 1950 to 1953 conflict was triggered by a North Korean surprise attack, the demonstrators mobilized in Pyongyang promoted their government's versions of events and accused the United States of provoking the war and leaving Koreans with, quote, wounds that can never be healed. At the rally Sunday, North Koreans also expressed pride in Kim's expanding nuclear weapons and missile programs, insisting their country now has the, quote, strongest absolute weapon to punish the U.S. imperialists and the war deterrence for self-defense, which no enemy dare provoke." And I mean, this is a pretty classic imperialist framing in the sense that the DPRK was the aggressors then and now, and that the U.S. was just sort of this, innocent, magnanimous force there on the Korean Peninsula. But, Greg, I was hoping you could help us understand the real context and history of the Korean War and Washington's role in it. And I think a lot of Americans also don't realize that this war is still technically going on. And so what do you think we need to understand about the Korean War, and why does the U.S. continue to frame the conflict in this way?
Of course, it looks quite a bit different as usual, American imperial policy, or if you're on the receiving end of it. So they're probably not would not have been a Korean War had it not been for the U.S. role to begin with. So as World War II was drawing to a close, the Soviet forces had reached Korea, and they had agreed with the United States to divide the Korean Peninsula. And it was an American general who drew the border between North and South Korea, making sure to include Seoul in the southern portion. There was supposed to be, just like in Vietnam later on, there was supposed to be a nationwide general election for the people to decide who they wanted, right? And when 1948 rolled around, the United States had arranged for South Korea to hold a separate election, thereby violating the agreement to have a nationwide general election. And this election in South Korea was opposed by the entire political spectrum in South Korea, except the extreme right. And naturally, the extreme right was the party that won. And Syngman Rhee was, during the World War II, he resided in the United States. And he was flown after the war to Tokyo on a U.S. military plane. And from Tokyo, he was flown on General Douglas MacArthur's personal plane into South Korea as the U.S. selected president for South Korea. But going back a little bit before then, after the Japanese were defeated in World War II, and of course, Korea was a Japanese colony at the time. It suffered brutal repression. But with the defeat of Japan, Imperial Japan, people's committees were spontaneously rising up throughout the Korean Peninsula. People were forming their own local governments in the northern part of the Soviet-occupied portion of Korea. These people committees went on to basically form the government. In the south, Japanese collaborators, the Koreans who had collaborated with the Japanese, and Japanese police, who were still on the Korean Peninsula, were utilized to crush the People's Committees and all left movements the U.S.-backed landowners and collaborators as a bulwark against communism. Syngman Rhee was extreme right, and he immediately launched a program of vast repression. So he established what was called National Guidance Alliance. So anybody who was suspected of being a communist or left or even moderate liberal or even a trade unionist was risked not only losing their jobs, but being imprisoned, tortured, and even executed, unless they agreed to join the National Guidance Alliance, and in which case there was like a re-education program where you had to renounce communism. This the brutal repression triggered an uprising in Jeju Island, which was crushed, and 30,000 people were killed by Rhee's government, and homes were burned. There was vast repression throughout South Korea. And the border that the U.S. had drawn between North and South Korea, well, no Korean had agreed to the division of the country. In Korean, the minds of Korean people, both North and South, this was one nation. So there were cross-border raids leading up to 1950, and artillery barrages across border. So where exactly does the Korean War begin? I mean, there was a conflict throughout South Korea. There were conflicts across this artificial border all along. Then officially, and as the official start of the war was June 25th, 1950, when the North Korea troops crossed the border. But if you look at I.F. Stone's Hidden History of the Korean War, which was recently reissued by Monthly Review Press, he quotes some initial reports saying that South Korea had crossed the border into North and attacked the North, and they were driven back. Later reports said, no, no, that didn't happen. It was North Korean troops who just went across. There's some ambiguity there about what exactly happened. At any rate, there was conflict going on long before June 25th. This was a civil war, and it was the United States that internationalized the civil war.
And, you know, Greg, this history is so incredibly important, particularly dispelling the myth that the war was actually triggered by North Korea, even if there is ambiguity and, you know, uncertainty about, you know, who actually started what. Was it the North that went across the border first? Was it the South that went across the border first? The fact is that the United States created the border and created this conflict to happen. And I'm wondering, amidst the North Korean people taking to the streets, over 120,000 people that participated in Sunday's mass rallies in support of their government commemorating the end of the war, how does this history of U.S. imperialism play, not just in North Korea, and of course, with many of the people protesting against U.S. imperialism very specifically, but how does this history play in South Korea? Because I find it hard to believe that the South Korean people don't see the same problem, the same enemy as the North Korean people see, which is U.S. imperialism that put them in this situation where they are at odds with one another.
South Korea is a deeply polarized society. So you have a vibrant labor movement, vibrant progressive movement, wonderfully militant people who are anti-imperialist. On the other hand, you have people who are absolutely in adoration of the United States and U.S. policy, and fiercely anti-communist. So it's, if people think the United States is polarized, it's nothing compared to South Korea. Again, there's propaganda that has an influence on the right in South Korea. And anyway, as far as the history was very painful on both sides. So after the war started, initially the South Korean forces were driven all the way down to Busan, just a small area of South Korea. But then the U.S. intervened, and South Korea regained their territory. And of course, later on, they went on under North Korea. At any rate, once Rhee was reinstalled as president in Seoul, after South Korean troops regained Seoul, He launched a program of attempting to counter what he called subversion. So anybody he suspected of being communist or having, quote, collaborated with North Koreans who were there during the brief time they had occupied Seoul, they were immediately arrested, executed, tortured. An estimated 200 to 400,000 South Koreans were killed by Rhee's government. And he didn't just go after suspected leftists, but any suspected leftist who was executed, he then went after all their family members, you know, brothers, sisters, parents, you know, daughters, sons. He killed the whole family. This had a huge impact on the society. And for decades after, people couldn't even talk about the people who managed to survive couldn't even talk about the loss of their loved ones, because the National Security Act was still in force that basically criminalized sympathies, quote unquote, for communism, right? So even expressing what you suffered was enough to risk losing your job and being basically an outcast in society. So this had impact on the South Korean society forever, for a long time. And to some degree, it still does. The National Security Act is still in force, although it's obviously not put into practice in quite so harsh a manner. But I have talked to some South Koreans who were in prison just for like having a magazine of like, say, comparable to Monthly Review, right? And they get their homes raided and so forth. In North Korea, of course, the impact was absolutely devastating. So U.S. bombers basically obliterated every single city. The countryside was filled with homeless people because the homes were destroyed everywhere. When South Korean troops advanced with American troops into North Korea, there were right-wing paramilitary South Korean military groups and police who rounded up North Koreans, anybody suspected of being political, executed tens of thousands of people, maybe even hundreds of thousands. You'll never know how many people were murdered. People were hung from posts as a warning to other people in North Korea. The U.S. suspected that and of course, if you destroy people's homes, you have a countryside filled with refugees. Well, U.S. policy was that maybe some of these columns of refugees might be harboring a North Korean soldier or two. Therefore, it was the U.S. policy to strafe refugee columns and bomb them with napalm. South Korean villages and North Korean villages, both U.S. planes hit them. So this had impact through devastating impact throughout the entire Korean Peninsula. And of course, because of the division of Korea, how many families cannot see their loved ones anymore? Had there been the general election throughout the entire Korean Peninsula that the U.S. and Soviet Union had agreed to, and which the U.S. violated, they might well never have been a war to begin with.
Yeah, and last question, Greg. Why is the Korean Peninsula so important to U.S. imperialism that the aggression continues decades later?
Yes. I could say South Korea is like the old saying about the Balkans, is that our tragedy was building a home in the middle of a highway. So you could say, in a way, the same thing about South Korea, the geographic position, its proximity to China and Russia, make it basically the keystone in the U.S. encirclement of China and Russia. So the U.S. is there to stay because it's just too important a place for the U.S. military to apply pressure on China and Russia. And if I may digress for a moment, during the Korean War, General Douglas MacArthur and actually many people on the right in the United States wanted to expand the Korean War into a World War III and take on China and Russia. And Douglas MacArthur had sent planes across the North Korean border into China, bombing and strafing Chinese airfields and railways. And they also sent two airplanes into Russia to bomb a Russian airport 60 miles north of North Korea, the border. It's really an ideal position if you want to launch a war against China or Russia. It's just a perfect position. So that's the importance.
Definitely. Well, we thank you so much, Greg, for joining us today. We're going to leave it there. We'll move to a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back.